Chabad Danurg Audio.
This lecture is presented by Rabbi Lezer Gurkov, Rabbi at Congregation Beth Tfilah in London, Ontario.
This evening we discuss Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya. He was one of the leading sages of the Academy in Yavne. After his teacher Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai passed away, he succeeded Rabbi Yochanan to the position of Av Bet Din, the Supreme Justice of the Jewish people. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya was a beloved scholar. He was a very popular rabbi. The masses loved him. He had a very soft-spoken way and a very loving way about him. And he was not only popular in the academy, but outside on the street as well. Unlike Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya was destined for Torah from the very beginning. His parents supported his Torah path, and the Talmud tells us that before he was even born, his mother brought him to the study hall and to the synagogue so that he can hear, even as a fetus in utero, the sounds of Torah learning. It's interesting, only in the last decade or several decades has science begun to appreciate the importance of the fetus's consciousness yet before it is born. And in the Talmud, there's an appreciation of the influence we exercise upon the fetus yet in utero so many years ago. The Talmud also testifies that after he was born, his mother brought him to 24 different study halls so that the rabbis who devoted their lives to Torah study would be able to pray for this child, Yehoshua, that he grow up to be a Torah scholar. In fact, his teacher, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, when he offered praise to each of his students, he said of Rabbi Yehoshua, Ashre Yoladito, praiseworthy is the mother who brought him into this world. Rabbi Yehoshua was the son of Hananya, and through his father he inherited his position as a Levite. He was a member of the tribe of Levi. His specific duty in the Beit HaMikdash was as a mishorer. He was a singer, he was a member of the choir, he was a cantor. He was obviously very good at what he did, and there was one time when he wanted to help his colleague who was a guardian of the gates. And one of the other duties of the Levim, of the Levite families, was to guard the gates in the Beit HaMikdash. And so he wanted to help Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgoda to guard the gates. Rabbi Yochanan then said to him, Yehoshua, this isn't appropriate. He said to him, Chazor b'ni, return my son. Sha'ata min ha-meshorerim, for you are from the singers or the cantors. Velo min ha-shoarim, you are not from the guardians of the gates. Rabbi Yehoshua also later recorded a memory that he had from many years back, when he said that he recalled that during the holiday of Sukkot, people never went to sleep. And he outlined the schedule that Jews followed during the course of the holiday of Sukkot. He said in the morning, people would come to the temple, to the Beit HaMikdash, so that they can attend the early morning sacrifice, the Tamid Shel Shachar. After the sacrifice, they would leave the temple and go to the nearby synagogue to pray the morning service. After the Shacharit, after the morning service, they'd return to the temple so they can witness the offering of the Musaf, the additional sacrifice in honor of the holiday. And then they would go to the nearby synagogue and they would pray the Musaf prayer. From there they would go to the academy where they would study Torah. From there back home to eat and drink. And then it was back to the synagogue to pray the Mincha prayer. And then back to the temple to witness, to attend the offering of the Tamid bin Harabayim, the evening offering. And so from the evening offering, they went straight to the festivities of the Sukkot holiday, Simchat Bet HaShoeva, and they spent the night dancing and singing and juggling and performing all kinds of acts of merriment, as the Talmud in the Tractate of Sukkot describes so graphically. Of course, the Talmud asks, if they spent all night dancing and all day praying, studying, eating, drinking, and attending the sacrificial rite, then when did they sleep? It's impossible for people to go 7 days without sleep. And the Talmud said they were so well packed in the Beit HaMikdash when they stood during the festivities that they would simply take quick cat naps each on each other's shoulders as they were standing. Incidentally, this particular testimony also has value from a different perspective. just certifying for us or confirming for us that during the course of the years of the Second Temple, Jews brought sacrifices and also prayed concurrently. In fact, there is a Rashi in the Book of Kings that tells us that right beside the Beit HaMikdash there was a great big synagogue where the pious men used to go to pray after they would offer their sacrifices. And so the prayer rite, which began during the Babylonian exile, not only continued during the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, when the Jewish community primarily lived in Israel, but was intensified, it was strengthened, it was widened, and Ezra, who led the Jewish people when they returned to Israel yet many years earlier, he had a hand in strengthening and in solidifying and standardizing the concept of prayer. Rabbi Yehoshua, who lived at the very end of the Beit HaMikdash and witnessed its destruction, testified that indeed the prayer rite continued all the way through the times of the Beit HaMikdash, that is to say, the second Beit HaMikdash. As a Levi, Rabbi Yehoshua collected tithes. And this is an interesting concept because we know Rabbi Yehoshua is a very poor person. And Rabbi Akiva testified that he transferred Rabbi Yehoshua's, the produce Rabbi Yehoshua collected in his tithe collections, and Rabbi Yehoshua was Rabbi Gamliel's tithe recipient. Being the recipient of the Nasi's tithes, he was certainly the recipient of a great deal of wealth, because 10% of Rabbi Gamliel's wealth is also wealth. And Rabbi Akiva testified that he transferred Rabbi Yehoshua's tithes, the Miser produce, into gold coins. And so it is possible, at least according to the Sefer Hadoros, that Rabbi Yehoshua grew wealthy as a result of collecting tithes from Rabbi Gamliel. There's an interesting discussion with regards to the question of whether a Levite was permitted to take tithes during the time of the Second Temple, because many Levites remained in Babylon. And we know that Ezra decreed, as he penalized the Levite tribe, that they would not be permitted to collect their tithes because they remained in Babylon. And yet here Rabbi Yehoshua collected his tithes. And so two answers, probably more answers are offered, but two of the answers that are offered is that A, Ezra did not offer a blanket prohibition against all Levites. There were exceptions for those Levites who were proven to be pious and devoted, and Rabbi Yehoshua was surely among those. And the other answer that's offered is that while Ezra did penalize the entire tribe of Levi, he did not prohibit them from receiving tithes, from collecting tithes. He simply opened the tithes to the Kohanim, to the priestly family as well, thus causing a monetary loss to the tribe of Levi, penalizing them for their reluctance to leave the exile and return to serve in the Beit HaMikdash. Nevertheless, Rabbi Yehoshua lived nearly 400 years after Ezra, and the fact that this discussion was ongoing even during the times of Rabbi Yehoshua demonstrates that Ezra's influence outlived Ezra, and of course we still live today under the glow of Ezra's light and surely under his influence. Rabbi Yehoshua was a very, very poor person. In fact, we discussed this when we talked about Rabbi Gamliel, and we discussed that Rabbi Yehoshua, according to most opinions, made his living off fashioning needles. Some say he was a coal worker, which was Rabbi Gamliel's initial guess. And then Rabbi Yehoshua said to Rabbi Gamliel that it is a shame that the leader of the generation doesn't know how the scholars of the generation make a living, which implies that he was not a coal worker. Nevertheless, some claim he was a coal worker, and he simply was responding to the fact that Rabbi Gamliel never knew what he did for a living until he came to visit him in his home. Some say he was not a coal worker, but a glass blower, from the word pacham, which can also be translated as a glass blower. We know that he traveled on business. You may recall when we discussed the story of Rabbi Gamliel that there was a time that Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yehoshua were both on a voyage at sea, and their purpose was, at least Rabbi Yehoshua's stated purpose was, business. And supposedly he was traveling to sell his needles. Rabbi Yehoshua was a member of the Sanhedrin when the Sanhedrin still sat in Yerushalayim in the Beit HaMikdash. They likely did not sit in the regular place where they usually convened in the Beit HaMikdash, because we know that the Sanhedrin vacated their spot 40 years before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. It is likely that when Rabbi Yehoshua joined the Sanhedrin, it had already vacated its usual place in the Beit HaMikdash. Nevertheless, he was a member of the Sanhedrin during a time when a bone of the human remains was found somewhere in the temple. And because a bone was found, the members of the Sanhedrin were concerned that there might be remains of human bodies buried elsewhere around Jerusalem, and they decided that it might be worth to declare a temporary moratorium on visitation to Jerusalem and declare all of Jerusalem a zone of tum'ah, of impurity, until they can undertake a mass inspection and find whether there were or there weren't bones or human remains buried anywhere in Jerusalem that was unknown and unmarked. Because by Jewish law, if you as much as touch or even hover over a bone of a remains of a Jewish person, then you become impure and thus unfit to enter the temple and to partake in the sacrificial rite. Well, Rabbi Yehoshua immediately stood up and resisted the attempt. He said, "What a shame upon us if we were to declare our holy and beautiful city to be impure." He said, "Lo busha uchlimahi, is it not a shame, shenigzor tumal Yerushalayim, that we should declare a state of impurity upon Jerusalem?" And then he said, "If you claim that there might be hidden bones, then where are the remains of those who died in the flood? Noah's flood. Where are the remains of those who died during the awful massacre of Nebuchadnezzar during the destruction of the first temple? We must say that those remains were here and they were since removed. So too, whatever other remains may have been in Jerusalem must have since been removed. And the fact that we found a bone somewhere in the temple grounds is just a coincidence and it's not something to extrapolate from." We know that Rabbi Yeshua in general was not pleased with overextended stringency. He did not like to overreact and to restrict too much. He didn't feel that restrictions were the proper way to go about things. In fact, there was one day that the students of Shammai and Hillel convened and they ruled on 18 matters in accordance with the opinion of Shammai. And during that time, they introduced a whole series of restrictions, such as the prohibition to drink milk that was milked by a non-Jew, even if it's kosher, the prohibition to eat bread that was baked by a non-Jew, even if it was kosher, the prohibition to eat food that was cooked by a non-Jew, even if it was kosher, the prohibition to carry in the public domain on Shabbat, even if you're carrying less than 4 cubits, 4 amot at a time, if there is someone who's not Jewish who can carry for you. So Rabbi Eliezer, who in general was a strict person and he was inclined toward restrictiveness, he was very proud of the achievements of that day. Despite the fact that Rabbi Eliezer was a student of Hillel school, he was happy that Shammai's view had won the day during that particular debate, and he said that they filled the measure, so to speak. They did a good thing. They filled the study hall with restrictions. In other words, they built many fences around the Torah that day. Rabbi Yehoshua responded and said they erased the measure, meaning that they caused more trouble than positive, because when you restrict too much, then the people are unable to live up to your level of restriction, and then they begin to permit themselves little license here and there, and before you know it, they're permitting themselves to transgress even biblical prohibitions. And so it's best to always consider carefully before you promulgate a new restriction, a new restrictive law, to carefully assess the ability of the congregation to live up to this particular restriction and to adopt it into their personal lives. And if you find that it exceeds their ability and makes life too difficult, you should pull back, because it's better to be less restrictive, and this way we preserve the biblical prohibitions. Rabbi Eliezer thought the more restrictive we are, the more we'll preserve the biblical prohibitions. Rabbi Yeshua thought that it's possible to overdo this and to have too much of a good thing, which is also not very good. Rabbi Eliezer compared it to having a bucket full of mushrooms and putting a bit of mustard in, which would preserve the mushrooms. It would act as a preservative. These little fences that the rabbis introduced would preserve the biblical restrictions. Rabbi Yeshua said we can compare it to a bucket full of honey into which someone dropped pomegranates and peanuts. That wouldn't do anything for the honey. On the contrary, it would just ruin things. Another example that's given is a bucket full of oil and someone poured in water, simply diluting the oil. So Rabbi Yeshua was very unhappy with being overly restrictive. After the destruction of the second temple, there was a group of Jews that called themselves the Essenes. And these Essenes were very They were ascetics. They denied themselves all forms of physical pleasure. In fact, they denied themselves the right to marriage and to procreation, and as such, they literally doomed themselves to extinction, because the only way to recruit new members would literally be by recruiting new people, because their members would not produce children who would be natural candidates to join the movement in the next generation. So in fact, they petered out after nearly a century or a century and a half. But during that time, of the destruction of the temple, they determined that they would stop eating meat and stop drinking wine. Rabbi Yehoshua addressed them and he said, "Bani, my children, why is it that you stopped eating meat and drinking wine?" So they said, "How can we eat meat if the sacrificial rite has become extinct? And how can we drink wine when wine was used as a libation on the altar? How can we eat and drink such foods without remembering our incredible suffering and our mourning of the loss of the temple?" So Rabbi Yehoshua said, "In that case, how can you eat bread? There were flour offerings that have now become extinct. And how can you eat fruit? There were produce offerings that have now become extinct. And how can you drink water? There were water libations that have now become extinct." "Ah," he said, "my children, come and I will tell you. To mourn, to not mourn at all is impossible, because our sages have already instructed us to mourn. But to mourn more than they have instructed us to, more than the measure, is also not good, because you cannot decree a restriction upon the community that they are unable to adopt into their lives. And so what should we do? We should simply do that which our sages instructed us to do, and not come up with new restrictions. For example, our sages instructed that when you put lime covering onto the walls of your home, you should leave one area uncovered to remember the destruction of the temple." So you see again that Rabbi Yehoshua felt very, very strongly about the importance of not being overly restrictive for the populace, for the people. It's easy to restrict for those who are already reverent, but he was worried about the average person on the street. That made Rabbi Yehoshua beloved to the people of Jerusalem and in general Klal Yisrael, the Jewish congregation, because they knew they had an ally in the academy in Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya. You also see from here that he loved all people. He addressed the Essenes in very loving terms. "My sons, my children," he said to them very softly, "let me talk to you about this. I care for you." Rabbi Yehoshua, in a word, really cared. Rabbi Yehoshua also said, despite his incredible love for Torah, he said that those who cannot live a life of Torah study, it is enough for them to study two laws in the morning and two laws in the evening, and that would be considered sufficient for their obligation to study the Torah. Now, for those who can study more, Rabbi Yehoshua was uncompromising in the requirement to study Torah. Someone asked Rabbi Yehoshua, "When is it permissible to study Greek?" And so Rabbi Yehoshua said, "You'll have to find a time that is neither day nor night, because the Torah tells us that both our day and our night have to be devoted to the study of Torah." In other words, Rabbi Yehoshua said, if you're capable of Torah study, you're not permitted to waste even a moment to study Greek. It's interesting that the family of the Nasi, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, they taught their children Greek. So they had a different attitude on this particular question. But I bring this up to show the dichotomy that Rabbi Yehoshua, on the one hand, demanded total dedication from those who were capable of it, but he was very tolerant and understanding of those that were incapable of it, and tried to create a synthesis between the two so that both the people on the street as well as the people in the academy would be able to be fully dedicated and capable of following every law of the Torah. He never wanted us to excessively restrict to make it too difficult for the people on the street. Rabbi Yehoshua, as we mentioned, once explained that Rabbi Yehoshua, as we mentioned, was a person that did not like excessive restriction, and he spoke about the pious fool. He said, a pious fool, as well as the pious fool and the religious, radically religious person are those who will destroy the world. What is the pious fool? The pious fool is the person who sees a woman drowning in the river but won't jump in to help her because it's forbidden for a man to maintain physical contact with a woman. What is the religious, radically religious person? Someone who closes his eyes on the street so that he shouldn't gaze upon a woman and then hurts himself by walking right into a wall. In other words, Rabbi Yeshua said, be religious and be observant and be reverent, but don't overdo it. Sometimes your zeal can cause more trouble than positive. And so Rabbi Yeshua was very careful about those things. Rabbi Yeshua lived in a place called Pekin. Pekin was a little town between Yavne and Lud. It is interesting that Yavne was the hometown of the academy where Rabbi Gamliel was the dean, and Lud was the location where Rabbi Eliezer established an academy. And so Rabbi Yehoshua was literally between Yavne and Lud, not only geographically, but also figuratively speaking, because he was stuck really between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer on many occasions, as we've already outlined in our discussions on Rabbi Gamliel. As I mentioned before, when his teacher passed away, he became the Av Bet Din in Yavne, the Supreme Justice. Nevertheless, there were times that he remained in Pekin, and he was visited by his students, just like Rabbi Eliezer was visited by his students when he was in Lud. And the Talmud tells us that there were once two students that visited Rabbi Yehoshua in Pekin. And as Rabbi Eliezer did, when his students visited him, Rabbi Yehoshua asked the students, what did you learn today in the Beit Midrash? What was new in the Beit Midrash? So they said to him, well, we are your students, and we drink from your waters. We study from your Torah. So why don't you tell us something, Rabbi? He said, nevertheless, I'm sure there was something new today. There's no such thing as a convocation of the academies, of the sages in the academy without a new innovative Torah thought. Tell me, he said, whose week was it? In other words, was this the week when Rabbi Gamliel gave the sermon, or was it the week that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah gave the sermon? And what did they talk about? So they told him that it was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's week, and that they were talking about the requirements to make pilgrimage to Jerusalem during the festivals. And they said there's a requirement for the men and the women to go, but why should the children go? There's no requirement upon children before the age of Bar and Bat Mitzvah. And they said it is in order to bring merit to those who bring them. It's an extra mitzvah to the parents that they bring along their children. Rabbi Yeshua said, ah, what a gem you had in your hands, and you wanted me to not to take advantage of it. You wanted to deny me that gem, meaning this beautiful teaching. You wanted to deny me that teaching by asking me to teach you. He says, what else did they learn today? And they shared with him a few more teachings that were offered on that day under the tutelage of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And he said to them, ah, what an incredible man Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is. No generation that plays host to such a rabbi can ever be called an orphaned generation. And furthermore, he said that he has an ultimate respect for Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. The Talmud concludes, why were they hesitant in the first place to share this information with Rabbi Yehoshua? And he says, because they had heard about the story of the student who had offered information to Rabbi Eliezer and was treated to a punishment where his eyesight was taken from him, as we described when we talked about Rabbi Eliezer. Despite the fact that later Rabbi Eliezer prayed for him and restored his eyesight, they didn't want to take this chance. But, on the other hand, they were dealing with a very different kind of character. They were talking to Rabbi Yehoshua, the patient, loving, easygoing Rabbi Yehoshua, not with the stern, demanding, exacting, strict character of Rabbi Eliezer. We know that Rabbi Eliezer was indeed, as I just mentioned, patient and welcoming and soft-spoken in comparison to Rabbi Eliezer. There is a story about a proselyte that came to Rabbi Eliezer. She wanted to convert. So Rabbi Eliezer said to her, tell me, what type of person are you? What is your moral character? So she said, well, first off, I want you to know that my youngest son is a child of my oldest son. In other words, I slept with my oldest son and gave birth to my younger son. So Rabbi Eliezer said, ah, if this is the least of your sins, and that's the first one that you share with me, then I'm sure that you're not serious. And he denied her conversion and kicked her out of his academy. And then she came to Rabbi Yehoshua, who accepted her. So the student said, Rabbi Yehoshua, Rabbi Eliezer will not accept, and you will. And Rabbi Yehoshua said, it's all right. I know that if those are her softest sins, then her gravest sins would include idolatry. And we have a tradition that those non-Jews who are guilty of idolatry and want to join the Jewish faith will not live a very long time. God will take their lives so that they will be punished in this world and not need to receive punishment in the world to come. So I'm not worried that I'm bringing charlatans into the Jewish faith, because I know that she won't last long. And on the contrary, I'm helping her along, because the punishment for her sins will come to her in this world. So he was more he was more soft-spoken and understanding and tolerant, as we explained before. The Talmud tells a story that one day, the king, in fact this was the king Hadrian, gave permission to the Jewish people to rebuild the temple. At that point, some of the neighboring tribes, the Kutites, came to the king and said, "We have proof that the Jews are going to use this opportunity to stage a rebellion against you." So he said to them, "What can I do? I've already granted them permission. I cannot deny them." So they advised the king that he can just simply tell them that he wants them to change the location slightly, or to make it a little larger or a little smaller. And the king gave those orders. And as the Kutites suggested, when the Jews heard these instructions, they were forced to withdraw from the building effort, because it is not permissible to change the structure of the temple. Well, having been offered this beautiful opportunity and then having it dangled in front of their faces only to have it withdrawn, this irked the masses and they became enraged against Rome. They gathered in a valley in which they started to complain and to scream and to rally and to demonstrate, and the sages said, "Whom can we send that would calm the spirits, calm the storm?" And they said, "Rabbi Yehoshua is the right man for it." Rabbi Yehoshua went up and he told a story, a parable. He said, one day the lion was eating and he choked himself on a bone. So he called out, "Whoever can remove the bone from my throat will be rewarded." Along came a bird with a long beak, stuck his beak into the lion's throat and pulled out the bone. And the lion didn't bother rewarding the bird, and the bird started to cry. The lion said to him, "Bird, don't you see? You're the only being that has ever had his head in the lion's mouth and lived to tell the tale. Isn't that reward enough for you?" And Rabbi Yeshua said, "We are the little bird in the mouth of the lion, which is Rome. The fact that we are alive today is reward enough for us. That we weren't permitted to build the Beit HaMikdash is sad, but we should be satisfied with that which we have. If we try to establish mount some form of rebellion, there's a good chance that we will not survive our foray into the lion's mouth." Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua disputed many, many issues, and there was one famous dispute that resulted in Rabbi Eliezer's excommunication, the banishment of Rabbi Eliezer from the academy. We've described that when we talked about Rabbi Eliezer, when we talked about Rabbi Gamliel. Nevertheless, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua were great friends. They studied together, as we talked about this before. They studied in the academy of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. They also served Rabbi Yochanan together. They were the two pallbearers who carried Rabbi Yochanan out of Yerushalayim when Rabbi Yochanan disguised his own death and as a subterfuge in order to escape the siege of Jerusalem. And they also served together. They had mutual duties in the Sanhedrin. They were both members of the Sanhedrin, and they were both the linguists. There were four linguists in the Sanhedrin, three of which are identified: Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Eliezer, and Rabbi Yehoshua. And these were the people that can speak so many languages, so that anyone who would come to testify before the Sanhedrin could speak in their native tongue, and there would be a member of the Sanhedrin who could understand them. So some members of the Sanhedrin were given the duty to study languages, and Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Eliezer were very talented in this regard, and they served together in this duty. As we mentioned last time, when we discussed Rabbi Eliezer, they were invited together to social affairs, as they were invited by Avuya to the circumcision of Elisha. And we also know that after Rabbi Eliezer passed away, Rabbi Yehoshua eulogized him passionately and described the seat upon which he sat as the seat of Har Sinai, and the person who sat upon that seat as Moshe Rabbeinu himself. Rabbi Yehoshua was a great mystic. He learned the order of mysticism from his teacher, that is to say, from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And the Talmud tells us an incredible story in the Tractate of Chagiga. The Talmud says that one day Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananiah was walking along the street, and he turned to the person that he was with, that was Rabbi Yossi HaKohen, and he said, "Come, let us study together the works of the chariot." That is a highly mystical prophecy from Isaiah and from Ezekiel, from Yeshayahu and Yechezkel, the prophets. This was in the middle of the summer, and as they started to study, the sky filled with clouds, and a rainbow appeared, a gorgeous, beautiful rainbow. And the angels filled the valley they were in, and they started to dance before Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehoshua as people dance before the bride at a wedding. When this was told to their teacher, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he responded, he declared, Ashreichem, praiseworthy are you, and praiseworthy are the people who gave birth to you, and praiseworthy are my eyes who merited to see what I just saw. And he said, I too had a dream the other night, and I saw myself and all of you, we were gathered at Mount Sinai, and a voice came down from heaven saying, ascend to here, ascend to here, there is a great big palace, and there are beds prepared, and there are chairs prepared, come yourselves, and your students, and the students of your students, you all have a place prepared on Mount Sinai for you. So we see from here that Rabbi Yehoshua was very proficient in the Zohar, in the Kabbalah, in the study of Jewish mysticism. In terms of halachic tradition, there was once someone who commented that the laws of Shabbat are like mountains that are hanging on a hair thread. What does he mean? There are very few verses in the Torah. There's very little text in the Torah about the laws of Shabbat. And yet, in the oral tradition, there are pages upon pages of laws with regards to Shabbat. And so this individual said, Shabbat are like mountains of laws based on a flimsy little text in the Torah. Because the truth is that the laws, they come not so much from the text of the Torah, but from the tradition that Moshe received from God on Mount Sinai and taught to the students of his generation, and they in turn transmitted it to the next generation. Rabbi Yehoshua felt himself obliged to respond, and he said that it's just like a pair of pliers. To fashion a pair of pliers, you need to put it in the fire. How can you touch it once it's in the fire? It heats up. The only way to touch it is to have another pair of pliers. So one pair of pliers can generate hundreds of pairs of pliers. But who generates the first pair of pliers? That, as we see in the tractate of Avot and Ethics of Our Fathers, that was created by God. And in the same way, he said, this is a parable for the Torah. Because one text, one verse in the Torah can spawn hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of laws. But who is responsible for the very first text? What is the origin of the text of the Torah in the first verse? The answer is, it is God. Rabbi Yehoshua was called upon because of his soft-spoken ways to represent the Jewish people in diplomacy with Rome. There was a time that he had to visit with a noble woman, a Roman noblewoman, that all the great honorable people of Rome would visit her because she was in a very influential position. On his way to this woman, he stopped. Before he entered, he took off his tefillin. Then he walked in and he closed the door behind him. And then when he came out, he went to the mikveh. His students who accompanied him till the home and saw him take off his tefillin, walk in and close the door, then come out and immerse himself into the mikveh, had ample opportunity to suspect that he had a liaison, a rendezvous, so to speak, God forbid, with this Roman noblewoman. So when he came off the mikveh, he said to them, so what did you think when you saw me take off my tefillin? So they said, we thought that you don't want to wear holy tefillin in an unholy home. And why did you think I closed the door? So they said, we thought you have a matter of national importance to discuss with her, and that's not for public consumption. So he said, what did you think when I went to the mikveh? So they thought, we suspected that maybe as she was talking to you, she spit upon you by mistake. Some of her saliva landed on one of your robes. And our sages decreed that when one is in physical contact with a non-Jew, that one should assume that one is in a state of impurity, since non-Jews are not careful with regards to purity and impurity, and therefore one should go to the mikveh. Well, Rabbi Yehoshua said, that's precisely what happened. And then he said, just like you judged me in a positive manner, I hope that you also will always be judged in a positive manner. Rabbi Yehoshua was one of the sages who went along with Rabban Gamliel to Rome, and during his visit to Rome, he was successful in a number of diplomatic efforts, including that story we talked about when we discussed Rabban Gamliel's diplomatic efforts, where there was one particular decree that the sages found themselves powerless to address, but they were able to influence one of the members of the Roman Senate to take his life in his own hands in order to save the Jewish people. Not that they influenced him or asked him to do this, but he was so impressed by these rabbis that he offered on his own. He went ahead and committed suicide in order to stay to offer a stay of the decree for the Jewish people. So Rabbi Yehoshua was along with Rabban Gamliel during that time. During his visit to Rome, he made a very favorable impression upon many people in Rome, and there were a number of debates that he held with people in Rome. One such debate was actually held with Rabban Gamliel. We mentioned before, when we discussed Rabban Gamliel, that Rabban Gamliel also engaged or conducted many debates while in Rome. And so while he was in Rome, he saw Rabban Gamliel seem rather despondent. So he asked Rabban Gamliel, what seems to be the problem? So Rabban Gamliel said, a Roman fellow, a philosopher, asked me a question I didn't know the answer to. So he said, Rabbi Yeshua said, maybe I can help. So Rabban Gamliel said, how long is the gestation period for a snake? And so Rabbi Yeshua said, I know, the answer is 7 years. And he explained how he knew, and he had inferred it from a verse in the Torah. The Torah says that God cursed the snake that he would be worse off or more cursed than the domestic animal and the wild animal. And since we know that the domestic animal generally has a gestation period of 50 days, and the wild animal has a gestation period of 12 months, which is 7 times 50 days, then the snake must have been cursed to be 7 times 12 months. If the wild animal is 7 times more cursed than the domestic, then the snake must be 7 times more cursed than the wild. So it must be a 7-year period. So Rabban Gamliel is said to have returned to this Roman philosopher and said, I have the answer, 7 years. The philosopher then banged his head against the wall and said, oh, what should I do? He said, it took me 7 years to follow a snake and have him in my aquarium, watching him carefully to see how long it would take, or watching her carefully. And here the rabbis in 1 minute achieve what took me 7 years to achieve. It's impossible to keep up with the rabbis of Israel. While he was in Rome, he was asked a question about the resurrection. He was asked, how is it, can you prove to us two things, that God knows the future and that he will resurrect the Jews at the time of the redemption? So Rabbi Yeshua replied that God, there's one verse that can prove both questions. The verse is, when God speaks to Moshe and says to him, Hincha shoche v'imavotecha v'kama ha'am hazeh v'zana. Behold, you will lie with your ancestors, that is, you will die and you will be buried with your ancestors, and this nation will arise and they will turn from God. And so Rabbi Yeshua read the text in the following way. Behold, you will lie with your ancestors and rise. This nation will turn away. He used the inflection of the words and rise to connect it together with the words you will lie with your ancestors, rather than where it usually is placed. And so he said, look, we know that God will resurrect the dead because he promised Moshe that he will lie with his ancestors and rise. And we know that God knows the future because he promised that the people will turn away from him. So his interlocutor responded, no, you're reading the word vikam and rise incorrectly. It should read, you, behold, you will sleep with your ancestors, you will lie with your ancestors, and this nation will rise. So Yeshua, in a brilliant entrapment, gimmick of entrapment, pointed out to his debating partner that he had at least conceded that this verse proves that God knows the future. Because his debating partner himself said that the word and rise belongs to this nation. And so God had predicted that this nation will rise and turn away from him. While it is true he had not yet proved the concept that Jews will be resurrected when the Mashiach comes. Nevertheless, this question was posed to Rabban Gamliel and he successfully answered the question, and the Talmud brings a whole list of verses that help us prove from the Torah text itself that the resurrection is in fact in store for us, and it's an article of our faith. Rabbi Yeshua was approached by someone in Rome who said, the best among the Jews are like thorns, because there is a verse in the book of Micha, I think it is, where it says, Tovim, the best of you, kechedek, are like thorns. And so Rabbi Yeshua said, read the end of the verse and you'll understand the context. The end of the verse says, Yashar mimaseicha, that is, the upright are protection for you, they cover for you. And he said, from the context you understand that the beginning of the verse is also positive. What does it mean, the good ones among you are like thorns? So he explained, it means that when there is an opening in a fence, unless the thorns of the wood of the fence actually extend out into the opening, protrude into the opening, people would be able to walk into the ark. So the thorns protect the opening. And so there are some Jews that aren't as brilliant, and they're not as pious, and there are some other Jews who are very good. And so the Torah is telling us the good one among you protects for those who expose you to vulnerability, like a thorn protects the opening in the fence. And then, of course, the upright offer protection as a covering would offer protection. So that's another debate Rabbi Yeshua had. Now, when Rabbi Yeshua visited Alexandria, Rabbi Yeshua was quite the traveler. Rabbi Yeshua visited Alexandria in Egypt, and he was asked 12 questions. The Talmud actually lists the questions and defines three questions as foolish questions. The Talmud says he was asked whether Lot's wife was considered a dead person, and whether if someone touched her, she would be considered impure. We know that Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt when she looked over her shoulder to the burning city of Sodom. Well, Rabbi Yeshua dismissed this question and said, a dead body confers status of impurity, but not a pillar of salt. They also asked him questions about how can one succeed in study of Torah. And so Rabbi Yeshua responded, you have to study diligently and work less time than you devote to study and pray to God. So someone asked him, how do you succeed in business? And so he said, you have to engage honestly in business, and you have to spend a lot of time at it, invest a lot of time, and you have to pray to God. And so they asked him, how can you ensure that you'll have good children? As we discussed, Rabbi Eliezer had wonderful children, and we said it's because he was a modest man. And so Rabbi Yeshua indeed said, when you are intimate with your wife, do so modestly, meaning think holy thoughts while you're with your wife, and that'll draw down a holy soul to your child. So he was a person that when people had an opportunity to ask him questions, they would always ask, because he was an encyclopedia of knowledge. He also made a positive impression upon the emperor. It's unclear whether the specific emperor of the story I'm about to tell was the emperor Trajan, or whether it was the emperor Hadrian. We know that Rabbi Yeshua had many discussions with Hadrian, because he's named in the Midrash as the debating partner of Rabbi Yeshua in many instances. But this particular story seems to fit with Trajan a little better than Hadrian. The emperor asked Rabbi Yeshua, what will I dream about tonight? They say you are a very wise man. Tell me what I'll dream about. So Rabbi Yeshua said, you will dream that you will be taken captive by the Persians, and that they will force you to feed their animals with a golden spoon, with golden implements. It was such a weird dream that the king thought about a day and all day long, and at night, indeed, he dreamt about what had consumed his thoughts all day. So this was a ingenious method of actually predicting and becoming a self, of having a self-fulfilling prophecy, giving the king something so weird that it would remain in his mind all day, actually ensuring that he would dream about it. Why does it seem to fit with Trajan? Because Trajan, toward the end of his reign, that was in the year 129, he actually lost a military campaign against the Persians. Another story with the emperor, and here it's unknown whether it was Trajan or Hadrian. It was either of those two that were emperors during Rabbi Yeshua's time. Hadrian took over in 129 after the death of Trajan, and he was the emperor that permitted the Jews to build the Beit HaMikdash at first, but then turned into the Jews' sworn enemy when they mounted the rebellion of Bar Kokhba. And after the rebellion was crushed, Hadrian introduced a series of devastating decrees against the Jewish people, known as the Hadrian Laws, the Hadrian Decrees. So the emperor, when he was still a friend of the Jews, he asked Rabbi Yeshua, tell me, what is it that you, the Jewish people, put into your food that makes it taste so wonderful? Because Rabbi Yeshua hosted him for a Shabbat evening, and the emperor was very impressed. The emperor ordered his cook to make the same kind of menu as the food he ate in Rabbi Yeshua's home, and it just didn't come out as good. And so Rabbi Yeshua said, we have one ingredient, and it's called Shabbat. That ingredient makes our food taste special. We also are going to learn that Rabbi Yehuda also hosted the emperor of Rome in his day, and he also gave him the same answer. Shabbat makes food taste very special. But this emperor was very insistent, and he said, I want you to give me that ingredient. He didn't understand what Shabbat meant. Rabbi Yeshua said, this ingredient only works for those who observe Shabbat. If you don't observe Shabbat, then the ingredient simply doesn't work. I remember when I lived in L.A., there was a restaurant that sold chalent on Sunday afternoon. My wife and I thought to ourselves, if we order chalent on Sunday, it simply won't have the same taste. And so we wondered whether or not the chalent would remain on the menu for long. Indeed, the next time we frequent in that particular restaurant, the challenge was off the menu for Sunday afternoon. If it's missing the Shabbos ingredient, then it's simply not the same. The Talmud tells the story of a silent debate that Rabbi Yeshua conducted in front of the emperor. Again, we don't know if it was Trajan or whether it was Hadrian, but the debate consisted of a heretic, or maybe it was a Hebrew Christian, who pointed out to Rabbi Yeshua by pointing across the room, saying that God had left the Jews behind. And so Rabbi Yeshua, in turn, stretched out his arm. And with that, he indicated that God was still protecting the Jewish people. And so the emperor asked Rabbi Yeshua what was the meaning of the debate. And Rabbi Yeshua was able to decipher both his as well as his opponent's indications. But the emperor asked his opponent what was the nature of the debate. And his opponent understood what he meant to say, but he did not understand Rabbi Yeshua's response. The emperor flew into a rage and he said, "How dare you make these motions in front of the emperor when you don't even know what it means?" And he decreed that individual be executed, be put to death. So there is another particular debate that took place between the emperor and, between Rabbi Yeshua and someone else, this time in front of the emperor. Now, it is interesting that they used to have debating houses that they called Beit Avidan. And many of the Torah scholars tried their best to avoid these debating houses because there was no way to win. If you lost the debate, then you lost. And if you won the debate, then you had to deal with the wrath of the person whom you have defeated. And so Rabbi Yeshua used to frequent these debating halls. So Rabbi Yeshua one day stopped frequenting them. And the emperor actually sought him out and said, "Where are you? You haven't been to the debating hall in a while." So Rabbi Yeshua responded in a very interesting way. He said, The summit of my mountain is capped in ice. The foot of my mountain is covered in snow. My mill no longer grinds. My dog no longer barks. And I'm constantly looking for something I never lost." What did he mean? He spoke in code. He said, "I'm too old and too weak and I can't do this anymore. My summit is covered in snow," meaning my hair is turned white. "The foot of the mountain, the foothills of the mountain are covered in snow." That means my beard has turned white. "My dog no longer barks." That means my voice no longer carries. "My mill no longer grinds." That means my teeth no longer eat. I can't get enough nourishment and energy. "And finally, I'm always looking for something I haven't lost." That means I walk around bent over all the time as if I'm looking for something I haven't lost. So there's another indication that Rabbi Yeshua was a frequent debating partner with the non-Jews, and he constantly engaged in these debates in which he defended the honor and the pride and the integrity of the Torah and of the Jewish people. Here are a series of debates that the Midrash actually identifies as Rabbi Yeshua having held with Hadrian himself. Hadrian said to Rabbi Yeshua, "It seems from your Torah that God creates angels every day. So where does he put yesterday's angels?" So Rabbi Yeshua said, "He puts yesterday's angels in the same place that today's angels came from." So Hadrian said, "And what is that place?" Rabbi Yeshua said, "There is a river in heaven, it's called Nahar Dinor, and that's where these angels are placed." So Hadrian said, "And is this river like the Jordan? Does it constantly flow?" And Rabbi Yeshua said, "Yes, indeed it is." And so Hadrian asked, "What is the source of the river? What is the wellspring from which it flows?" And Rabbi Yeshua responded, "It is the sweat of the angels who carry the chariot." And this is a very deep mystical concept that is discussed at length in the works of Kabbalah and Hasidus. Nevertheless, Rabbi Yeshua, who was a great mystic, as we explained, put it in very simple terms for even a person like Hadrian to understand. Hadrian once asked Rabbi Yeshua, "Can you tell me, please, of which bone will the body be resurrected? Does the body not decompose completely and return back to dust as it was?" And so Rabbi Yeshua said, "There is one bone in the back of the neck, and it's called Luz, and that is the bone that will be from which the resurrection will begin." So Hadrian said, "How do you know?" So Rabbi Yeshua said, "If you have such a specimen, give me the loose bone, and I'll show you." He tried to burn it, and it didn't burn. He tried to dissolve it in water, and it wouldn't dissolve. He tried to crack it with a hammer, and the hammer broke in half. This bone was just simply not breakable. And that was the bone, Rabbi Yeshua said, from which God will restore the human body when during in the time of resurrection. Hadrian once approached Rabbi Yeshua and said, "It seems from your text that God is compared to a lion. If he's a lion, then how strong can he be? I know many Roman soldiers who can subdue a lion." So Rabbi Yeshua said, "No, he's not like a temporal lion. He's like a supernal lion, a lion of heaven." So Hadrian said, "I'd like to see the lion." Rabbi Yeshua tried to dissuade him, but Hadrian insisted. So Rabbi Yeshua prayed, and the supernal lion, so to speak, descended. What is it? What does a supernal lion mean? The Talmud doesn't explain. But the Talmud says that when this lion was a distance of 400 parsa from Rome, a great distance from Rome, he roared. He opened his mouth and let out a roar. And from the incredible vibration and sound of his roar, all the women of Rome miscarried. All the pregnant women in Rome miscarried. When he got a little closer to Rome, he roared again. And when that happened, all the people of Rome lost their teeth, and the emperor himself fell off of his seat. And the tower of Rome began to sway back and forth as if it was about to fall. And so at that point, Hadrian turned to Rabbi Yeshua and said, "I think that's enough. I get the message. Please pray that the lion goes back to heaven," which is exactly what Rabbi Yeshua wanted, and that's what he prayed for, and the lion returned to heaven. Whether or not there was a true lion or Rabbi Yeshua was simply praying for these symptoms to occur is an interesting question, because it's a question of whether the Talmud was literally telling us as it was, or simply telling us in a manner that we should imply for ourselves the true meaning. Hadrian once said, "I insist on preparing a feast for your God." After all, Hadrian was a product of a pagan nature with mythical gods, and so the idea of offering food to a god, a god that they believed eats and sleeps and fornicates and fights and is jealous, this wasn't a foreign idea to a Roman person. And so Rabbi Yeshua tried to dissuade him, and he said, "Our God has so many angels, he has an entourage that is so great and such a great staff, there's not enough time for a human being to prepare a meal that will satisfy all of God's needs." So Hadrian insisted. He said, "I have a great staff too, I too can do this. Show me where I should do the work and I'll do it." So Rabbi Yeshua identified a spot that was in front of the ocean, and it was a wide open spot where the winds would blow and the ocean would rise, and it was just a wide open spot of very extreme weather patterns. And so Hadrian the emperor instructed his staff to go out to that area, and they worked for 6 months throughout the summer to prepare this great meal. And then a great wind started blowing and blew all the food out into the ocean. So Hadrian then, not dissuaded, told the staff to work again. They worked throughout the winter for 6 months, and a great rain came and washed it away. So Hadrian asks Rabbi Yeshua, "What is this all about? We work so hard and our plan keeps on being foiled. Rabbi Yeshua said, "No, your plan wasn't foiled. You did in fact serve. You served two of God's legions. You served his sweepers, namely the wind, and you served his sprinklers, namely the rain." In those days, most people could not afford to lay down a floor of wood or any other material, so most houses had earth floors. And so after sweeping, they had to sprinkle some water to keep the dust down on the ground rather than having it rise up during hot, dry days. So every wealthy person had sweepers and sprinklers. And so Rabbi Yeshua said, "You fed his sprinklers and you fed his sweepers. Now it's time to feed the next part of his entourage." And so Hadrian said, "I get the message. I understand it's too much. There's no way I can ever provide for all of God's legions, and so I will give up the effort." Hadrian also asked Rabbi Yeshua for the gestation period of a snake, and Rabbi Yeshua replied that it's 7 years. Hadrian then asked, "But what about the fact that in Athens there are some wise men who had conducted an experiment and discovered that it took only 3 years?" And so Rabbi Yeshua responded that it must be that they made a mistake, and the snake that they started with was already pregnant 4 years before they began. So Hadrian said, "But these are wise men. Surely they would be able to conduct a controlled experiment." Rabbi Yeshua said, "They might be wise, but we're wiser." And so Hadrian said, "If that's the case, bring these men before me and we'll have a debate. And we'll shortly get back to the story in which we'll describe how Rabbi Yeshua succeeded in that undertaking of bringing the wise men of Athens to Hadrian in Rome." But first we'll talk about two debates that Rabbi Yeshua conducted with the princess, with the daughter of Hadrian. Again, here we're not certain if it's the daughter of Hadrian or the daughter of Trajan. It's the daughter of the what the Talmud calls the Caesar, because of Julius Caesar. All of the Roman emperors are referred to in the Talmud as Caesar, from the name Caesar. So the daughter of the emperor, whether it was Trajan or Hadrian, asked Rabbi Yeshua, why is it that such beautiful Torah is in such a disgusting container? Because Rabbi Yeshua was definitely a wonderful person, but he was not very handsome. In fact, he was an ugly-looking man. And so Rabbi Yeshua replied, what does your father store the wine in? Does he store it in wooden caskets, or does he store it in gold and silver caskets? So she said, he stores it in wood. Everybody stores it in wood. So he said, but your father is the royal monarch. He should store his wine in gold and silver. And so she instructed that the wine be stored in gold and silver caskets. A few weeks later or months later, the wine went bad. The king asked the princess, who told you this idea about storing in gold and silver caskets? So she said it was Rabbi Yeshua. So he called Rabbi Yeshua, he summoned Rabbi Yeshua, and he said, why did you give my daughter such nasty advice? And he said, I didn't give her any advice. I simply replied to her in the same way she talked to me. She wanted to know why a beautiful Torah should be contained in an ugly container. And so I explained to her, just like wine is best preserved in simple wood and not in beautiful gold and silver, so too is Torah best preserved in people that are not concerned with their good looks. And the less good looking they are, the less concerned they will be, so the more attention they can focus on Torah. So of course the Talmud says, but there were many very handsome people who were great Torah scholars, giants in Torah knowledge. And the Talmud said, had they been less handsome, they would have been less preoccupied with their looks, and they would have been more devoted to the Torah, and hence would have been greater scholars. So Rabbi Yeshua's position was not that one should, God forbid, be neglect one's appearance and walk around with unkempt and unlaundered, etc., because the Talmud is very clear about how it's the obligation of every Torah sage to appear presentable. But in terms of one's looks, even if one really doesn't care for one's looks, if you are good-looking, you cannot avoid having some inclination toward enhancing your looks. But if you're completely not attractive, then you don't have that inclination in the first place, and you can devote all your energy to Torah study. That was Rabbi Yeshua's position. Well, this daughter of the emperor was also a bit of a chutzpinyak. She was quite an audacious person. So she turns to Rabbi Yeshua and she says, your king, your God, he is like a carpenter. Because it says, Hamikarev Amayim Aliyotav, that he builds up the heavens with rows of water. So ask him if he can make for me a simple spool upon which I can roll my thread. I can spin my thread. So Rabbi Yeshua was tired already of her games, and so Rabbi Yeshua prayed that she be afflicted with leprosy. In Rome at that time, there was a custom that those who were afflicted with leprosy were placed in the center of the marketplace. And they were given spools so that they can spin yarn around spools and they can do something constructive with their time. And why were they in the marketplace? So passersby can see them and take pity and pray to their gods that these people be healed. They didn't have a medicinal response to leprosy. All they had was their prayer. They had their mythical gods, and they had their prayers. So this woman, who, though she was a princess, was placed in the marketplace with the spool. And one day Rabbi Yeshua was walking by, and he recognized her, and he said, how do you like the spool that my God gave you? So she said to him with anger, she said, tell your God he can take it right back. Rabbi Yeshua said, our God, he gives, but he never takes. We return now to the story of the debate Rabbi Yeshua conducted with the wise men of Athens in an effort to bring them back to Hadrian. First he arrived to Athens. Hadrian had supplied him with a ship according to his request that had 60 compartments, and in the 60 compartments, each compartment had 60 cushions or 60 chairs. When he got to Athens, he first had to find the location. These wise men were eccentric and they didn't want anyone to know where they were, and they didn't want anyone to enter their home. So Rabbi Yeshua engaged one individual to show him where the wise men lived, and because he was afraid of actually showing that, because if they would discover that he had compromised their location, they would come after him. So Rabbi Yeshua made an agreement with him that he would simply walk along the streets, Rabbi Yeshua would follow at a discreet distance, and when he came upon the house of the wise men, he would sit down as if he were resting, and then he would go on. Rabbi Yeshua would identify the house that way. Rabbi Yeshua found the house and he watched it. He clandestinely watched it from a distance. He mounted an operation of just watching the comings and goings of the home. And he found that there was a very thick wall around the house, and there were guards stationed both on the outside of the wall and the inside of the wall. To pass through the wall, you literally had to pass through quite a walkway. The door in the wall was the breadth or the thickness of the entire wall. And so the purpose of the guards on the outside is to ensure nobody comes in, and the purpose of the guards on the inside is to ensure that nobody comes out. And if anyone should come in, they would execute the guards from the outside, and if anyone would come out, they'd execute the guards from the inside. And every day they would check the sand that they had laid down or the bran flower they had laid down in the entranceway to see if there were footsteps heading in or out, and this way they would know if their guards ought to be executed or not. So Rabbi Yeshua waited for the evening until the guards fell asleep, or according to another opinion, he simply walked into the doorway but didn't walk through or past the doorway. And during that time, he reversed one shoe so that he was wearing a shoe backwards and another shoe forward. And he walked through the doorway from the outer entrance to the inner entrance, and then turned around and walked back. So he left two sets of footprints, two heading in and two heading out, because you recall that he had one shoe facing forward and one shoe facing backward. In the morning when the wise men checked the footprints, they thought that both somebody had come in and somebody had left. So they, without asking questions, immediately executed both sets of guards, leaving the house unguarded for a moment and vulnerable, and Rabbi Yeshua entered. The Talmud tells us of how Rabbi Yeshua debated the wise men, and he had all kinds of interesting discussions, and in the end, Rabbi Yeshua, who had made an agreement with them that whoever, if he would win the debate, then the wise men were obliged to come with him to his boat so that they can have a drink with him on the boat. So once he won the debate, the wise men went with him to the boat. Now, I don't want to get into the details of the debate because that would take too long. But on the boat, he ensured that each of the wise men were shown to a separate compartment. And each of the wise men thought that because there were 60 chairs in that compartment, that very soon all of their friends would be brought into their compartment. So sitting there and waiting for their friends, they were a little bit off guard while Rabbi Yeshua ordered the captain to set sail for Rome. And indeed they did. They set sail from Greece to Italy. Modern-day Greece to modern-day Italy, from Athens to Rome. Well, without getting into all the details of the journey itself, the voyage itself, just to mention, Rabbi Yeshua took with him a clump of earth from Athens, a little clump of earth. When they got to Rome, all of the wise men were somewhat subdued because they weren't in their normal habitat and normal location. So when Rabbi Yeshua brought them before Hadrian, he saw that they weren't their usual feisty selves. And so Rabbi Yeshua threw their Athenian dirt before them. It must have been a fragrant piece of dirt because it brought back to them the fragrance and the echoes of Athens. And with it, their mood and their courage returned. And because they were eccentrics, they also behaved in front of the king as eccentrics. In which case, the king grew angry with them and in fact had them all punished. And in this way, Rabbi Yeshua himself was saved, because it is clear that had Rabbi Yeshua not succeeded in overwhelming the wise men of Athens, then Hadrian would have punished him for having insulted the wise men of Athens and said that their experiment with the gestation of a snake, who, as I mentioned earlier, was a faulty experiment. Rabbi Yeshua was so successful in defending the Jewish people and their philosophy and debating against the non-Jews that the rabbis were concerned when Rabbi Yeshua passed away, who would now defend the Jewish people? So they approached Rabbi Yeshua on his deathbed and they said, who will be our advocate? Rabbi Yeshua quoted the verse that says that when the children lose their advice, then the wisdom is lost. Usually it's understood that the children's wisdom is lost. Rabbi Yeshua interpreted it to mean that when the children lose the ability to offer advice, then the wisdom of their opponents will be lost. In other words, it won't be so necessary to engage in debates because God only provides the challenges that we have the resources to meet. And if God removes the resources, then He'll also remove the challenges, and so it won't be so necessary to worry about debates. In addition to his great knowledge of Torah and of mysticism and of diplomacy and whatnot, Rabbi Yeshua also was very familiar with witchcraft and sorcery. The Talmud tells the story that Rabbi Yeshua had a nephew by the name of Hananiah. Hananiah, the nephew of Yehoshua. And Hananiah was once in a neighborhood where there were a number of witchcraft practitioners, and they cast a spell upon Hananiah, who was a great scholar of Torah, and they, under the spell, Rabbi Hananiah violated the laws of Shabbos, and he rode a donkey on Shabbos in public. Rabbi Hananiah, when he discovered what had happened, was beside himself. He was in despair. He went to his uncle, and he asked him for some help. And his uncle, who was familiar with the ways of sorcery, was able to concoct some kind of mixture and spread it on his nephew's head, and with that, lifted the spell. But he advised his nephew, once they've cast a spell upon you once, they have control in some measure over you for the rest of your life. It's best that you leave Israel and go to Babylon. And so, indeed, Hananiah left Israel. There were a number of great rabbis that left Israel during that time. And it is suggested that possibly one of the reasons that they left Israel is because they were able to read the writing on the wall, and they saw that there wouldn't be a strong Jewish community in Israel for many years forward because of all of the incredible decrees and the tension that was boiling in Israel. And so they felt it was better to lay the seeds for new communities in new places where Jewish communities were growing and flourishing and burgeoning. So Hananiah went to Rome. Once in Rome, he began to declare the new month, the Rosh Chodesh. He began to act as if he was the Sanhedrin in Rome. And so, after many years of this behavior, the rabbis in Israel sent two emissaries to visit with him. These were his old friends who served alongside him, yet in the Beit HaMikdash, where he was one of the musicians in the orchestra. His uncle was a singer, and he was a musician. So he told the students, gather around and listen to what these two men have to say. They are wise men, they are pious men, they served alongside me in the temple. And so, everything Hananiah said, these men from Israel disputed. If he said kosher, they'd say non-kosher. If he said pure, they'd say impure. So Hananiah lost his patience and he said, I changed my mind, they aren't wise after all, they're very foolish. So they said to him, once you've built, you cannot destroy. Once you've locked, you cannot reopen. You've already established our reputation as wise men, then we're wise. So he said to them, if you're wise, then why do you insist on disputing everything I say? So they said, because we've been sent to you to determine why it is that you persist in acting like the Sanhedrin and declaring the new month. This should come out of Israel. Ki mitzion teitze Torah. Torah should come from Israel. So Rabbi Hananiah said, but I left, Rabbi Akiva, when he left Israel, he too declared the new month when he was in Babel, in Babylon. So they said, Rabbi Akiva's different. He left no one to compare with him back in Israel. He was the expert of the generation. So Hananiah said, I too am the expert in the generation. And they didn't dispute that. They recognized that. Hananiah indeed was the expert in the generation, maybe raised by his uncle, who, as we know, was a great expert in astronomy. He was very well versed in the laws of Kiddush HaChodesh, of establishing the new month. So they said to him, when you left, you were the expert. But now the little calves that you left behind have grown into fully grown bulls with great horns. In other words, they are great, formidable rabbis in Israel, and it is time to restore the glory of Israel back to where it belongs, because there are people who are capable of leading a Sanhedrin in Israel. And so they said to Hananiah, we are told to tell you that if you persist, then we will excommunicate you. And if you don't, and we should tell the congregation here, if you don't want to have a share in the God of Israel, then follow Hananiah. Let him build a new temple here and let him play his harp over here like he used to do in the Beit HaMikdash. And let his colleague be the one who leads you in the building of the temple. But you have no share with the God of Israel. And they declared, Ki mi Babel teitze Torah, should the Torah come out of Babylon? And are these Elam Moadei Hananiah, these the festivals of Hananiah rather than the festivals of God? This makes no sense. And so when the people heard that, they cried and they broke down and they said, indeed, of course, we want to have a share in the world of with the God of Israel. And Hananiah also withdrew his resistance and said he too will submit to the authority in Israel. Why was this? Because they recognized in Israel that still there must be one seat of central authority, and that the Jewish people should not become splintered. It wasn't too many generations after that that the Jewish community in Babel, in Babylon, grew to the extent that it rivaled and then even exceeded the Jewish community in Israel. And despite the fact that the Nasi of the Jewish people always lived in Israel, there were already great centers of study, Torah study in Babel, and there were incredible rabbis and luminaries of Torah in Babel. Nevertheless, until such time as the Sanhedrin disbanded and the chain, the unbroken link of semicha, of ordination dating back to Moshe, until such time as that chain did not end, which is roughly in the 4th century, in the middle of the 4th century, the authority for declaring the new month, and therefore also for declaring the new year, and which year would be a leap year and which year would not, always remained in Israel under the purview of the Nasi and the Av Bet Din, the president of the Jewish people, and the Supreme Court. Despite the fact that there was a separate hierarchy and infrastructure for Jews in Babel under the jurisdiction of the Reish Galuta of the Exilarch, still they would defer to Israel for the issue of determining Rosh Chodesh and the new month. Rabbi Yeshua offered a number of interesting teachings. Rabbi Yeshua said, "Never surprise your host and walk into his house before entering. Walk into his house without knocking before entering. Always knock before you enter." And the Talmud tells a story of how the rabbis in Rome went to visit a Roman person that they knew, and they knocked once, and he went to the door, and he saw no one, so he figured these must be the sages of Israel who are so polite, they want to inform him ahead of time that they will come. They knocked a second time, so he went and prepared himself, he washed, and he dressed. And they knocked a third time, so he opened the door, and then he saw them coming. Another story about Rabbi Yeshua is told that he offered the following teaching. If someone comes to your home and you don't know them, respect them, offer them hospitality, but suspect them, because they may also be a thief. And the Talmud tells a story that Rabbi Yeshua once offered hospitality to a person who came, and he gave him lodgings to sleep in the upper floor. In those days, there weren't staircases, there were simply ladders with a hole in the middle of the roof so you can climb up to the loft. Rabbi Yeshua removed the ladder after the man went up to the second floor. Indeed, in the middle of the night, the man spread his cloak and gathered all the valuables in Rabbi Yeshua's upper floor, and he put it all in his cloak and tied it up, and he went to the hole so he can climb down the ladder. It was dark, so he didn't know that the ladder was removed. So he fell. He fell and made this awful crash. And the next morning, he was still lying there, writhing in pain. And Rabbi Yeshua came up and says, "What are you doing? This is how you treat your host." The man misunderstood, and he said, he thought Rabbi Yeshua was talking about the fact that he's here writhing in pain. So he says, "What do you mean? I didn't know you removed the ladder." Rabbi Yeshua said, "It wasn't the ladder I was talking about, but your theft I was talking about. Don't you know that forever, all along, our tradition has been that we respect but suspect those guests that we don't know?" Rabbi Yeshua said that he was always at the winning end of a conversation. He always did well for himself in debates. But there was only 3 occasions in his life when he was outdone, once by a widow, and once by a girl, and once by a boy. The story of the widow is that Rabbi Yeshua once came to a widow's home, and she prepared a delicious meal, and he ate it all. The next day, she prepared another delicious meal, and he ate it all. The third day, in her zeal to prepare a delicious meal, she put in too much salt. So he ate a little bit and didn't want to eat anymore. So she asked him, "Why won't you eat?" So he said, "I'm not hungry." So she said, "If you're not hungry, why did you have all the bread?" Then she said to him, "Aha, I understand. Because there is a rabbinical dictum that one should never finish one's plate in the house of a host. You should leave a little bit so that the kitchen staff should have something to eat, because they keep nothing back for themselves from the pot. They put everything they cook onto the plate. Serve it to the guests, so the guests should remember them when he eats, and leave a little bit on the plate so that they can have something to eat. And since I realize you finished your entire meal yesterday and the day before, so maybe you're thinking that you'll leave all of your meal for me today, and this will make up for what you didn't leave yesterday and the day before." So Rabbi Yeshua smiled and says, "Well, I see you got me. Either I acknowledge that I did wrong by not leaving anything yesterday, or I acknowledge that I don't like the food because you put in too much salt." He said she got the upper hand in the conversation. The story about the girl is a very interesting story. Rabbi Yeshua was walking along a well-tread path in the middle of a field. The girl walked up and said, "This field belongs to my family and you're trespassing." So he said, "Am I not walking on a well-tread path?" So she said, who was the one that trod this path before you? Was it not a thief just like you?" She made her point. One day Rabbi Yeshua was walking to a city and he saw a little boy at a crossroads. So he said to him, which way is the easiest way to the city? And so he told him that there is a short but long way and a long but short way. So Rabbi Yeshua opted for the short but long way. He very quickly came upon an impassable area filled with orchards and private orchards and private gardens that he could not trespass and come through. But the city lied just beyond. It indeed was short, but it was long because you couldn't get in. You had to walk all the way back. So he comes back to the crossroads and he says, why were you mocking me? You sent me on a road that didn't lead to the city. So the kid said, I sent you on a short but long way. It's short to go there, but it's long because you have to return. Here is the long but short way. You can go the long way, and then when you get to the entrance, you can come right in. It's long, but it's short. Finally, the sages once sent Rabbi Yeshua to find out why it was. They heard a rumor that this man by the name of Shimon ben Antipater was constantly striking his guests. There were guests that were coming to his home, and before they left, he would take a stick or a whip of some sort to them and whip them and offer them lashes. So Rabbi Yeshua went to the home and he visited, and the man welcomed him in and treated him nicely and studied Torah with him and then gave him a place to sleep. And in the morning Rabbi Yeshua said, I want to go out and bathe. Where is the bathhouse? So the man showed him, pointed the way to the bathhouse. Rabbi Yeshua left his home and was worried that he might be struck from behind. But still, the man was nice to him. He went and he bathed and he prayed and he came home. The man gave him breakfast. And then he said, okay, it's time for me to leave. So the man said, okay, I'll accompany you. And Rabbi Yeshua was taken aback. The man was so hospitable, so nice all along. He said, listen, I have to tell you the truth. The rabbis in our academy, they sent me to you because Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was still alive. They sent me to you because they heard that you're whipping and you're offering lashes to your guests. And they said that they'd like to send me once again. And they'd send Rabbi Yeshua into contentious situations because he had a soft-spoken way of dealing with difficult issues. And so the man said to Rabbi Yeshua, listen, these are guests that come to my house and I offer them food and they swear in the name of the Torah that they will not eat food from me because they have plenty of their own. But I have such good food that after a while the resolve breaks down and they eat. Now I know that you're not allowed to take an oath and that if you take an oath and you break it, then you're in violation of a biblical prohibition and the punishment for that is 39 lashes. So I've been administering the lashes as a punishment for breaking the oath. So Rabbi Yeshua said, aha, if that's the case, I feel incredibly relieved. I'll tell you what, I'll go back and tell the sages in the academy that this is what you've been doing. And from now on, you should continue doing this. And not only should you offer 39 lashes, you should add another 39 on behalf of the sages in the academy. Well, the Talmud doesn't explain to us what Rabbi Yeshua's meaning here was and whether he was simply engaging in poetic license or whether he was exaggerating of some sort. Whether he was simply speaking out of an incredible sense of relief, but it seems odd that Rabbi Yeshua should advise that a person should take justice into his own hand and administer in a vigilante method not only 39 lashes, but actually double 39 lashes. But I bring the story again to demonstrate that Rabbi Yeshua was always the ambassador of the rabbis to deal with difficult issues, contentious issues, because he had a very soft-spoken way. So about him. So in conclusion, Rabbi Yeshua, the giant of his generation in Torah, was respected by his peers. He was the Av Bet Din, the supreme justice. And at the same time, he was beloved by the masses because he understood that the Torah, as it is seen by the great rabbis, is not the same Torah as it is seen by the unlearned people. And that it's important for the rabbi to try and view it through the lens of the unlearned, of the uninitiated, of the person who hasn't been given the same opportunities for being surrounded by the atmosphere and soaking up the environment of Torah, and doesn't have the same passion and zeal for it. Rabbi Yeshua was not a proponent of additional and extra restriction. Rabbi Yeshua was a proponent of understanding the mindset of the person on the street, even as he zealously guarded the actual Torah and the halacha itself, not only among Jews, but also among non-Jews, as reflected in the many debates that we shared tonight in our discussion of Rabbi Yehoshua. In summation, the sages of Yavne, of whom we have identified, of whom we have presented Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, and Rabbi Yehoshua, between the three of them, they created an incredible atmosphere of Torah learning that raised a generation that catapulted Torah learning into the future. They raised the likes of Rabbi Akiva, and after that, Rabbi Meir, and finally, Rabbi Yehuda, who we will learn about in the following sessions, and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and others. And together, these scholars contributed toward the incredible achievement of documenting the oral tradition and writing the text of the Mishnah.